Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Cullinane. In 1898, the United States went to war with Spain. The conflict sparked a debate over the identity of the United States. Is it a republic or is it an empire? Now, I don't want to diminish the empire building of the early republic in the sense that I think America has pretty much always been an empire of some degree or extent. There was the imperialism of Manifest Destiny. There was the Mexican-American War. There were the Indian Wars of the 19th century. Continental expansion and conquest were in many ways the equivalent of overseas colonialism that occurred after the War of 1898. So there's that long history. But there's three differences that seem to distinguish the acquisition of colonies in 1898. First, there's the scale of that conquest. Taking the Philippines, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and Guam meant displacing the sovereignty of 14 million people. Second, the territories that were acquired in some cases, like that of, say, the Philippines, Hawaii, and Guam, spread the American empire to geography far from the continent. It was non-contiguous with the rest of the nation. The war also had global consequences for the Pacific, the Caribbean, and for the Atlantic world. And third, and finally, the acquisition of the colonies did not follow the same pattern of continental expansion. And what I mean by that is that white settlers did not immigrate to the colonies, and the colonies would not eventually become states, although Hawaii would be the exception there. In time, Hawaii would become a state. Now, there are several wonderful books out there about the War of 1898, the acquisition of territories, the governance of these colonies, and even some people have written about the anti-imperial movement that opposed American colonialism. But I am not interviewing an author of a monograph today. The inspiration for today's podcast instead comes from the art world, and specifically from an exhibition at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. It's entitled 1898 U.S. Imperial Visions and Revisions. And if you're in the D.C. area, this exhibit is worth a visit. It's the first major Smithsonian Museum exhibition to examine the War of 1898. And to me, that last fact is hard to believe. We're 125 years out from the Spanish-American War, and there has never been an exhibit at the Smithsonian Institutes. This exhibition showcases more than 90 objects in order to present various perspectives of those who advocated for expansion, those who opposed expansion, and those who tried to have agency over their political futures when the United States came to govern these territories. It is on until February 25th, 2024. Please go and see it. The architects of the exhibition are the Smithsonian's Faina Carrigal, curator of painting, sculpture, and Latino art and history, and the acting senior historian of the Portrait Gallery, Kate Clark LeMay. With assistance, I should say, from Carolina Maestra, who they've mentioned several times in the interviews. She's the curatorial assistant for Latino art and history. Welcome to the podcast, Kate and Taina.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I want to say how much I enjoyed the exhibit I visited 2 weeks ago, but my natural inclination is to ask you, why 1898? I mean, what gave you the idea to recall the war, its aftermath, the great debate? And I also noticed that in your description of the exhibit, you said that the Smithsonian hasn't done this before. So why now?
Right. The Smithsonian has not undertaken an exhibition of this scale, exploring the overseas presence of the U.S. Its expansion overseas. Why did we decide to do this? Well, the exhibition was 6 years in the making, and Kate and I, from our different perspectives, me as a specialist in Latino and Caribbean history and art history and its relationship to the U.S., and Kate as an art historian who has devoted a lot of work to monuments and historical memory and war, we thought that the war of the conflicts that resulted in U.S. expansionism overseas in 1898 were really not at the forefront of of public memory in the United States. As a Puerto Rican, 1898 is a very critical year in our history, and it is it's often invoked in conversations, I would say, in certain circles almost on a day-to-day basis on the island, and it's a diaspora. And so I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware that as the person in charge of highlighting the Latino presence in U.S. history, that is one strong point of connection that is often overlooked. And so that is the case also for Filipino Americans, for people from Guam, for people from Hawaii. And we thought that was something that, that traversed all these communities and American history at large and art history. And so it was a good idea to spend some time on it, to do an exhibition about it, to do it comparatively. Yes, that's the story.
Kate, the same question goes to you as well. Obviously, Taina has this perspective as a Latina, and she wants to talk about the comparative nature of the war and the conquest, really. And so what was it for you that sparked the interest?
Well, I am a historian of American art. And like Taina said, I'm interested in how art helps us remember war. And so I've taken an angle in my first book about war cemeteries and monuments. And when we realized that we were looking at, well, there's all sorts of reasons. I mean, Taina and I have been talking for years, and we were sort of comparing notes about U.S. history. And I found it really interesting when she pointed out labels that were just so celebratory. And I hadn't really picked up on, that part of writing American history. And I became more and more aware of the Latina point of view through talking to Taina. And then I also realized in my own family history, I have this, ancestors who have fought in all sorts of American wars. And we talk about some, but we do not talk about the Spanish American War ancestor. And yet he is a closer sort of timeline than, say, the Civil War veteran, whose stories have been passed down. So I became aware, I think, of the gap of knowledge as Taina and I compared notes. And it actually took me a long time to even realize that my Spanish American War ancestor had been a part of this ugly, ugly war in the Philippines. He was a volunteer in Nebraska. So there's a lot of connections that we make as art historians from the art object to the history. And that is so fascinating, as we are both curators and historians of U.S. history, albeit, with different concentrations. But the 125th anniversary is also this year. So we felt that this was a very timely exhibition. It was kind of the moment to look again at the Spanish-American, Cuban-Philippine War, which we sort of call the War of 1898. And then to be more inclusive, we realized that the annexation of Hawaii should also be addressed because it was certainly part of the zeitgeist of that moment of the U.S. expansion across its, you know, across the seas and its interest in sea power. So that is sort of how it came about. Really, it was through comparing notes with a brilliant colleague.
Also, in terms of how you considered the exhibit, you mentioned labels and geography. There's a real beauty to the exhibit when you walk in. It's very imperial feeling. There are these banners on the wall that label the geography, you know, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, et cetera, right? And then there, it's like this feeling of a world fair. You know, the world fairs, they all had those the sort of international forums for cultures to show off like what's going on in the Philippines or what's going on in Cuba. That's the vibe that I got from it. But I'm wondering, as the designers of the space, what your plan was, or was that part of your thinking, and how did it come to be designed?
That's really a great question. We have a design and production department. And as we plan the exhibition, we meet with them regularly. We go over the current draft of the list of artworks that will be in the show, which evolves over time and over 6 years, which is a longer period than, you know, like museums work 2 and 3 years ahead, but 6 years is like really, we, you know, we, it was a different sort of, you know, different level of logistics, organization, and complexity for an exhibition like this one. And as the design and production department started to do, you know, to embark on their particular contribution to the project, which is to design the space, they came to us with some ideas. It's very interesting that their first idea was to use a color palette for the walls that was green and brown. And Kate and I looked at each other and we're like, but this is about the sea and the ocean. And so we need to think blue here. and it's derived, you know, tones, right? And so, but then the conversation flowed very, very smoothly. They came up with that brilliant idea of using the banners to identify each geography. And that was, I think, very, very smart. Many people have asked us about those banners, and they certainly lend a feeling, a feel that of World Exhibition sort of feel. And however, we were very clear also that this was a delicate endeavor in terms of design too. By no means we would have wanted to create a feel that was celebratory of this history, of course. You know, we wanted to maintain a critical perspective on all of this, and that had to be reflected in the design too. So at some point also, like, the text for the banners was like in diagonals, and it just seemed, it gave a very different look to it, and that was not as somber. And we said, no, we need to go for elegant and somber and serious, because this is a history with repercussions until today that need to be probed. But also, you know, the other element here that is that contributes to the design, but that it's separate from it, is the artwork. And Kate and I traveled to 74 collections around the world to all these different places that were implied in what we call the conflicts of 1898. And by that, we mean that amalgamation of the War of 1898, the joint resolution to annex Hawaii, and the Philippine-American War. And we found some incredible artworks that bring that story to life.
Yeah, I agree, actually. I did think, being the National Portrait Gallery, that there would be dozens of portraits from the usual suspects. And before we started the interview, we were talking about the John Singer Sargent portraits of Leonard Wood and Theodore Roosevelt and even Moorfield Story. But I was delighted to see some collections from Manila, and Puerto Rico. I mean, there's the, for example, the portraits of non-American combatants like Jose Rizal. I mean, can you say a little bit about these? I mean, fairly often, I mean, if the War of 1898 is forgotten, these combatants are definitely forgotten in American history, right?
Yeah, Taina and I from the beginning knew that we wanted to tell this history that was grounded in the U.S., but from a comparative point of view that put on equal terms the points of view of the Philippines, Cuba, Guam, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico with the United States. And, you know, you really cannot be a curator in 2016 thinking about this kind of project without being aware that the U.S., it should not be a U.S.-centric story. And Taina's personal experience growing up in Puerto Rico really helped us hone in on that. And then, you know, the fact that she's fluent in Spanish as her first language, I think really gave us an advantage to understanding the points of view outside of the U.S. And then Taina was talking about all the travel that we did and the 74 collections. I mean, we made that effort. I went to the Philippines twice. I went to Hawaii twice. I went to Guam once in order to familiarize ourselves with art of those places. Taina went to Spain. And she made multiple trips to Puerto Rico. We both went to Cuba, which was an experience in and of itself, right? Because
this sounds like torture, by the way. Your jobs sound really unglamorous and torturous.
Right? Well, it kind of was in a way, Michael, because we had to do this through the pandemic. And we were lucky that we got the majority of our travel out of the way. But going to Cuba in March of 2022, I was afraid I was going to get stuck there because of the multiple, do a testament of like you had done a test. And then we had to do a test, you know, with the only credit card in the island of Cuba to pay for it. But it was a whole thing. But we were very privileged to be able to take the time to visit those places. Yeah.
I mean, I know the job sounds like torture and it's... No, we're incredibly privileged to work in the art field because it's work that is inspiring on a every day we're inspired by art, by what artists the present of the past have created. You know, just to elaborate a bit on the difficult parts, this exhibition required a lot of fundraising to be able to do the trips that would make it possible. Kate and I had a very ambitious vision for this show in terms that we were not going to settle for a collection-based show on this chapter of U.S. history because it was going to turn into just a futile exercise and one that would be celebrating this history and not probing it. So the project required that we do all this travel, and that required also that we do all this grant writing, tons and tons of grant writing, which is the not fun part of all of this, of course, because you know it's you know how it is. You know, you're a scholar yourself. You know, you submit so many grants, you're rejected so many times. You are rewarded some other times, but it's really, it's labor intensive. And then there are the reports.
Oh my God. And like, if I have to write one more report, but you know, again, to get back to the positive, we were successful in the grants. We got a $250K grant from the Mellon Foundation that we're especially proud of. Once the Mellon, you know, put its weight behind us. And I mean, what a boon that was for us, frankly.
Well, it's good to hear that even the National Portrait Gallery has to, you know, struggle to get patronage, really, because we in the academic world, we all have to do it. It is a thing. And it's the rejection is difficult. The report writing is difficult. And then getting back up and doing it all over again for the next project. It's like a hamster wheel. But I want to, let's get to the art, because that's really where your passion is. And as you say, that's the big positive and the big takeaway. And for me, when Taina asked me before the interview, what sort of sparked my imagination most, or what I was most interested in when I came, I mentioned the Moorfield story charcoal that Sargent did. But in hindsight, the thing that really got me was not the portraits at the National Portrait Gallery. It was the scenes, the landscapes, which I had never seen before. And I had never actually, I'd obviously considered the perspective of other peoples involved in the war, particularly belligerents on the Filipino and Cuban side, but I hadn't really thought about what these places looked like. And there's a scene, a landscape of Ponce and the port, and there's also some of a Cuban peasant that's talking with a Spanish soldier. And to me, these were really new insights. And I was wondering, from your perspective, how important it was to consider the landscape and the scenery along with the portraits.
Very important. It was crucial. It was, yes, we're the National Portrait Gallery. We tell history through portraiture. We collect only portraiture. However, when we do history exhibitions, we do include in our shows sometimes other artworks or objects of material culture that are not portraits. And that was very important in this history, because it's a very, because the way we decided to approach it was so expansive. And so it was going to be very unfamiliar for a lot of people, even for people affected, directly affected by that history, who still remember the year 1898. They might know how 1898 affected the history of their own island or archipelago, but not necessarily of another one, right? And there were so many destinies that were changed that year, political destinies, through this U.S. overseas expansion into the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and the establishment of a U.S. protectorate in Cuba. So, so it was important to include scenes, you know, naval scenes, to include scenes that gave us an idea of the landscape of the of certain places, so that people could situate themselves in the city of Ponce, Puerto Rico, or in a rural town in Cuba during the Third War of Cuban Independence, or so that they could sort of envision the Battle of Manila Bay on the 1st of May, right? These are all artworks that help us give dimension to the conflicts of 1898 and to the people who were involved in them.
I mean, this was really fun for us, was to visit all these collections and kind of put our expertise as historians of art into selecting the works of art that would tell the best narrative, the most clear narrative, and yet through the best art. So we were able to work with curators from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which if you are a curator out there, you know how hard it is to get them to agree to any loan, right? So Taina and I are like very diplomatically strategic, because we wanted to make sure that we were able to borrow two of their treasures. It's called The Conqueror's Culebra Cut. And it's a painting by Jonas Lai that depicts the construction of the Panama Canal from 1913. And it's an incredibly modern work of art that captures the violence to the earth that was enacted through superior industrial technology that the United States employed. But it also captures the humanity of the workforce, who are kind of trudging out of this deep gash in the earth. And they're painted with not very much detail, but you can see the weariness in the slope of their shoulders. And it creates a real insight into what must have been a very difficult and sometimes treacherous experience for those workers, most of whom were from the West Indies. And then the other painting we brought from the Met and that we were quite proud of is the Winslow Homer painting, Searchlight on Harbor Entrance, Santiago de Cuba from 1902. And that is quite an homage to U.S. naval modernity in that it displays the use of the searchlight, which was invented in 1893. And so the fact that the U.S. was the only nation to put electricity on their vessels, and you're looking at this basically a moonlit seascape, seeing these searchlights coming out of nowhere, Homer really captured the very eerie feeling of surveillance, of being watched. And of course, on July 3rd, the Spanish fleet attempted to escape from this very narrow harbor mouth of the Bay of Santiago, and the U.S. Navy, which was sitting there waiting, sunk every last ship of the Spanish. So it's really a painting of the hunt. It's a painting of ruthlessness, and it describes the context of the war. But then you look over and you see a portrait of Leonard Wood or Jose Marti, and you're like, oh my God. You know, it kind of connects everything through the art, which was so fun for us. And we were able to, again, like work with curators and really brainstorm with them and share our ideas and get their support. And this is really why we do this, right? It's through the human connections that we all make in bringing history alive and hopefully, you know, teaching people who are interested.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think you've accomplished that. The portraits and the scenes really do. They have an important connection, and it comes through. It also comes through in other things, and not just the paintings, but you've got political cartoons there as well. And of course, this is the golden age of political cartoons. I was just wondering how you picked them, because I mean, there's been a lot written, I guess, about Cuba being depicted as a female maiden in distress, and there's millions of these images. How did you pick them?
Yes, we chose just a few of them because there has been a lot read about those images. You know, when when you speak about the visual culture of 1898, what comes to the forefront of people's minds is these cartoons, right? That infantilized the new colonies, that, yes, pictured Cuba as a maiden in distress, that very often had very racist depictions of the rebels, the revolutionaries in the Philippines and Cuba. And so we just chose a few of those. Notably, we have a drawing, a caricature of Uncle Sam surveilling and sort of claiming stake over Pearl Harbor. Towards the end of the show, we have another of a famous cover of Harper's Weekly that shows all the new colonial subjects in a classroom. I think it's called Uncle Sam's New Class or something like that. But we try to not be too repetitive of what has already been said and to discover new dimensions. And so one of our favorite parts, because it was so wild and bizarre and perverse, was finding all these board games and objects that that were commercialized during the war to promote the war in the United States. That is just a selection. Kate and I saw much more. We saw puzzles. We saw, I still think about the shot glasses with the faces of naval staff of the US Navy. And I have pictures in my head of people getting drunk with those.
Well, incidentally, I don't know if you know this, but George Dewey was so popular that he had a cocktail named after him. And it is delicious, but it's designed to orange bitters that are supposed to taste like Seville and cardamom seeds that are supposed to have a taste of the Philippines. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is an incredible period of consumerism. I loved the board games.
Yes.
Isn't it weird? Like, you love them, but you kind of want to, like Taina knows, I've confessed to loving them, right? But at the same time, they're so perverse that it's kind of like with hat in hand, I'm kind of like, yeah, I kind of really like these. But for me too, it's interesting. They draw a through line to like the war gaming that's done in professional military education and strategy schools, right, that are employed to this day within the U.S. military's teaching.
That's interesting. I hadn't even considered that. I just saw the bright colors and the sort of gamifying of war, but that's fascinating. I hadn't realized that. And Dewey had a lot of things named after him. Roosevelt would have, Leonard Wood. I mean, did you stumble across things that, like, for example, I know there was a washing machine named after Commodore Dewey. Did you find things that you just couldn't fit in the space that you had?
Oh yeah, all the time. Yes. And that was like, you, Taina, you remember when we would sing to each other, do we, because it was like, yes, this sheet music. We have all these insider jokes for our 6 years of working together that, you know, only Taina and our curatorial assistant, Carolina Maestra, will now understand. Everyone else will probably think I'm nuts. But I actually, we saw, Taina, you should talk about your trip to the Wolfsonian.
Right. Thank you. The Wolfsonian collection. There was the Wolfsonian Museum of FIU, Florida International University, Miami. It's a museum of propaganda, and it has an incredible collection around the war of 1898. And they have a lot of, well, among the many, many materials they have, from books to stationery produced in honor of the war, they have a huge collection of sheet music. A lot of sheet music was composed to commemorate the war at events, in hotel, reception rooms, you know, in all sorts of activities. And Dewey had many, many compositions honoring him. And one of them was called do we do? So do we do became a thing for us. And
do we do you want to marry me? Like it was
something like that, yes.
Sort of romantic. So we just thought it.
I'm going to find this and I'm going to post a link on the website so that we can have, and maybe we can get a reenactment. That would have been a great addition to the exhibit.
And I also found Taina, the fan, like Taina and I set our eBay alerts, and as one does, right? When you have 6 years of working on a show. And so I found this really cool fan that had it was a curiosity piece, right? So the spines of the fan were like stems of a pansy, and the leaves of the pansy there are four petals, if you will. And then on one petal, there's a portrait of one of the, you know, so-called heroes of the Cuban blockade campaign. And so you had Schley and Shafter and Hobson, Sigsbee, but then you also had McKinley and Roosevelt. So like, just throw those guys in for good measure because they are so popular, I think. But yeah, there's some really interesting like material culture just from that era that we had fun with.
One of the big, the objects, and I say big because it is enormous, is the Hawaiian coat of arms quilt. And that is something that if people go onto the website, they can check out the object. I don't know, will they get a sense of scale from what they see online and what it is in the room, but what inspired choices like that? Because that's a pretty obscure object that obviously tells the story of Hawaii in a way, but how do you stumble across that? And then how does that get in, but other things get left out?
We wanted to tell the story of Hawaiian resistance. You know, Taina was talking earlier about how we were sort of measured and limited our selection of caricatures because it's a painful history. And I think that you have to be very sensitive to the people who are still living with this history. And Native Hawaiians certainly are in that group, and they feel this history alive today in a way that's very painful for them. The flag quilt displays the Hawaiian flag on all sides of this very large quilt. And in the middle is the coat of arms of the Hawaiian monarchy. And the embroidery is exquisite. It shows two guards whose ears, right down to the detail of their ears, you can see the lobe of their ear is outlined in yellow embroidery, the two guards that are pictured in the coat of arms. And this was a wedding gift made after the overthrow, and we think probably around the time that Hawaii was annexed to the United States. So the overthrow was in 1893, and the annexation was in 1898, and then Hawaii became a territory in 1901, and then a state in 1959. But the fact is, this was an object of Hawaiian resistance, but also love of their queen and devotion. And it says so much more than what Taina and I could put in a label, right? To explain the continued feelings that Native Hawaiians have. So I think I also like to picture it as it was probably originally used, which was sort of wrapped around a canopy bed with a top rail of a canopy bed. So if you were to visit someone who had that flag quilt and maybe pass by their bedroom, you could see that they're still flying the Hawaiian flag.
So there's a lot of symbology in there too that harkens back to the various parts of Hawaiian history. So there's a St. George's cross, right, to represent the English sort of involvement in the islands. I suppose we could say the same about the Philippines as well. The Philippines is like 5,000 islands in the archipelago. I mean, it's probably the most demographically diverse place on the planet, not just in terms of the geography, but also the cultural differences, languages, ethnicities, religions. But in the exhibit, one of the things I noticed is that it tended to focus mainly on Luzon, the largest island in the archipelago, and on the ilustrados, or, you know, the sort of intellectuals of Luzon and Manila and Cavite, like Aguinaldo, Agoncillo, and Mabini. Did you think that there was more to tell about the Philippines? Did you think that there was more about Philippine resistance that went beyond Luzon and beyond those ilustrados?
Well, yes, for sure. There is a kind of, there's a commodity of space that we have to deal with. And in order to tell the points of view and give, you know, sort of the same kind of space to all, to Guam, for example, which always gets left out, you can't tell the entire history of Hawaii or the Philippines. And I hope that our show serves as a conversation starter, really, for, and I think it probably, it certainly has in Hawaii, I know that much. And people are taking the torch and maybe expanding the examination of history to make it more inclusive of what they would like to see representing, you know, more events. But in terms of the Philippines, yeah, it's a huge archipelago, not in at all of the one culture. And the revolution against the Spanish of 1896 was, you know, really led by Andres Bonifacio and Emilio Aguinaldo. And Bonifacio is not in the exhibition. We found one portrait of him that was in very poor condition and that was in a collection that was too far to ship to us. It was too costly. So we decided to kind of do an overview of the insurrection against the United States. But to tell where that came from, you really need to talk about Jose Rizal. And then to talk about where it went, you need to address guerrilla warfare. So we kept it as tight a narrative as one possibly can, to not lose the thread of the 1898 exhibition goals, which is really to highlight that year.
Yeah, I think that's a fair enough, you know, curatorial decision. I think there is so much to cover, which is almost the point that I'm making. I don't think, I think you have struck a narrative here. And I think it is that there are many perspectives, and this is not a criticism of it. I wonder myself about the Philippines. I wonder about, are there portraits out there of the Sultan of Sulu? I mean, I don't know, are there? And I think that in itself is an interesting question.
From the 16th century? Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a posthumous kind of representation of him by Juan Luna that we include in our book, actually. It's a really beautiful representation of the agreement between the Sulu, the Sultan, and the Spanish. We found the kind of armor, something very similar, at least, to the kind of armor that he was wearing.
Well, that's interesting as well. So that's in the Smithsonian collections.
Yeah, the Datu Sikatuna. And then, I argued for this to be in our book because this Juan Luna is probably the preeminent artist of the Philippines from the 19th century who, you know, lived into the 20th. A masterful painter. His name should be known by everyone, but he's kind of, you know, underrepresented. This is such an interesting kind of brings to light that detail of the Sikatuna's outfit.
The book does include much more than that's in the exhibit. I think that's a good thing to point out. And this just gets to my point about my broader point about, is 1898 just too darn big? And what I mean by that is, one of the portraits that I saw was the Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan. And it made me think of, and I don't know, I think you may have mentioned it in the, but I can't remember, the Insular cases, which are ruled in 1901, and they have an extreme bearing on the territorial sovereignty of all of these places, including their relationship to the United States. And I mentioned Moorfield Story's portrait, and I thought of that long history. And I mean, can you cover all this? You mentioned Panama is in the exhibit as well. And, you know, where do we draw the line on what gets in and what gets out? I know I've been asking that question again and again, but it's kind of like, I wish you could take over the whole floor and do 1898.
We did talk about that, doing our own, we had expansionist desires ourselves, you know, of taking over the museum with this show. Something we regretted to not cover was contemporary art, because there's a lot of contemporary artists from the current or former territories of the United States who are still making artwork about it. And so, yes, that is also covered in the book, in my essay. But yes, it's a really good question, Mike. I mean, like, it was very hard to delimit the scope of the exhibition. We knew 1898 was the flashpoint. Something that was very important to both of us was to have sort of an elastic timeline, which is the one we applied through the show, right? And as you go from gallery to gallery, from bay to bay, rather, because in the space, we wanted to start the history of each geography of Cuba and of Puerto Rico and of Hawaii and the Philippines before 1898. It had to start before 1898. We needed to provide some prior context in order to make it clear that these people and places did not come into existence in 1898, you know, through U.S. expansion. They had their own political developments, cultural developments. You know, things were happening there before. They had their own decolonial struggles. And so, and then, yes, we wanted to then shine a light on the turning point that 1898 represented for them. We sort of took a case-by-case approach to how far into the 20th century we went in each gallery. Something we do when we do the tour, when we tour people through the space, is that we are able to elaborate more on what happens in the 20th century, right? But
well, the one thing that struck me about what you're saying, Taina, is that when you're leaving the gallery, there's the video of the Rough Riders, which is an interesting sort of epilogue to the gallery, and sort of saying that this is the start of the American century or something like that.
Yes,
sure,
indeed.
That sounds good.
So the start of the American century, it's Theodore Roosevelt, with, you know, who you've written a lot about, and who has a very sizable ego, and is.
It's also the first time, really, it's the first time that film was used to record a war. And Diana,
yes, but it has. But there's this funny contradiction, right, in that film, that, yes, it's the first time that film is available to record a war, but that's not a scene. It's a replay. It's a reenactment.
It's a 1920 film from the short movie, wasn't it? It was called The Rough Riders.
No, it's actually, well, it's from 18. It was made shortly after the war, but it was made in Orange, New Jersey. The reenactment is in Orange, New Jersey, and it's of a battle in Cuba. So just look at the trees. Different in New Jersey as opposed to
the Hollywood before Hollywood. But yeah, I know what you mean.
And in the show, I just want to say that with the insular cases, I mean, that is a huge point that Taina especially delved into, and we recruited for our audio component Judge Helpy to speak about the legal aspect of John Marshall Harlan's case, you know, the insular cases of John Marshall Harlan as a lone dissent in the insular cases, Down versus Bidwell.
Right. He authored the dissent opinion, and I know you've also written about this, Michael, but yes, so that was important for us as a way, as a pointer, really, to the 20th and 21st century. You know, these are very consequential cases, and some lawyers who are invested in achieving civil rights and equity for people in the territories talk about the insular cases as the next frontier after Plessy versus Ferguson, right? The next legal frontier in finding appropriate constitutional representation for everyone. Kate and I really had an amazing experience co-curating this show, also with the assistance of Carolina Maestre, you know, and it's once you, you know, you work on this for years, you have to do an incredible amount of research with the goals that we put on our, you know, that we impose on ourselves, you know, of doing this comparatively. That became very, very onerous, really, and also very, it required, of course, that we reach out to numerous scholars across these different places to, and be very humble about what we knew or didn't know.
It's really easy to make mistakes. I mean, at least in my experience, I was reading some sources that just elaborated to the point of exaggeration, and I didn't realize, you know, this is actually not a good source. Or the sources that are native, that in at least in the history of Hawaii have been overlooked on purpose, because that story demonstrates resistance to the U.S. seizing of Hawaii. And that is a story that most Americans really would prefer probably not to know about, because it's a difficult one. It's painful.
Sure. It paints, forgive the pun, it paints the United States as the imperial conqueror rather than the benevolent assimilator, as McKinley had put it. I mean, the insular cases I'm fascinated by. I would love to ask you a lot more about that. And I think that your exhibit is, it truly does justice to all of the historians in the U.S. and those that are outside of the U.S. as well. I think it really has a broad base of research. I mean, there's another thing about all this too that I was thinking about, that it's a live issue. This is not, I know we're talking about it moving into the 20th century, but really this has moved into the 21st century. Neil Gorsuch has recently said that the insular cases are bunk and they should be basically eradicated from constitutional law because they have no basis, of which he has got, you know, a valid point. And my politics don't line up with Neil Gorsuch's, but I do think that's an interesting thing, that my politics don't line up with his, and yet there is some interesting common ground there. And it brings me to the great debate, which does feature in the show, in the exhibit, you know, the anti-imperialists versus the imperialists, and the domestic debate that goes on within the United States over whether it should be a republic or an empire. And you've got the banner up there that says republic or empire. And I suppose the question that I had for you is it a failure? Is the anti-imperialist movement a failure? I mean, and then how do you tell that story through the 20th and 21st century?
That is a fascinating question. And you're the second person to ask it in the last 2 weeks. Kate, do you remember when we were in Miami, someone asked that question, but on the sort of, they asked the reverse question, because even if the anti-imperialist did not succeed in preventing U.S. expansion overseas, the premise of their question was that, according to them, that the, you know, if the U.S. is an experiment, that part of the experiment has not worked out very well. And therefore, according to this person who asked the question, it is, they had a point. The anti-imperialists had a point. So there's a sort of an intellectual victory there. This is what we were asked in Miami 2 weeks ago when we were doing a book presentation. You know, it's an interesting perspective. You know, for us, it was very important to show in the exhibition that there was a debate surrounding this war. I think it's very easy as history marches on. And of course, you know, with the huge amount of books that were produced immediately after this war and for the next several decades, you know, celebrating this war, it's easy to remember it as a victory and to never question that whether, you know, it was positive or negative or, you know, what are the things that are still unresolved from this war. And so I think one of the parts that we enjoyed the most was curating that section, because it showed the debate. The debate had many different voices. It was contradictory the different agendas of the people under the umbrella of the Anti-Imperialist League were so, you know, how can you have Mark Twain and Ben Tillman in the same room? It's very odd.
It is. I also noticed on your portrait of Ben Tillman, it's a side portrait, so you can't actually see the ugly side of Ben. Well, they're both ugly sides, I think, but, you know, the one with him missing an eye.
Yes, he was mostly pictured in profile because he was missing an eye. So famously, he's mainly portrayed that way. But that portrait has a very interesting story because it came to us in 2020. A descendant of Benjamin Tillman, you know, called us and said, we have this portrait in our family, have had it for generations, and we cannot live with it anymore. He doesn't represent us. And Kate and I were like, wow, he can be in our show. You know, he's a really important part of the story, you know, within the anti-imperialist movement. We would be remiss not to tell that part. We don't have another portrait that represents it. And so that was really fortuitous.
It's a great juxtaposition of having the likes of Moorfield Story, the founder of the NAACP, nearby Ben Tillman, who admitted to stuffing ballot boxes and taking part in political violence against African Americans.
I was going to say a little bit about did the Anti-Imperialist League and movement fail? And I don't know, but one thing that it brought to mind is how during the Philippine-American War, the Filipinos were fighting guerrilla warfare style against the U.S. soldiers. And the U.S. employed concentration camps, strategics, like what the Spanish had done in Cuba and what the U.S. had, you know, criticized them for. That knowledge, because it was essentially a war that the U.S. was losing or not doing very well in, that knowledge of that war was not really put out there. And so, you know, the failure, as I see it, is in the recognition of parts of these conflicts that are maybe embarrassing, you know, to some people in the United States, or a difficult history, certainly at the time, maybe not as much embarrassing now, but what would the officers in charge of strategy during Vietnam have done differently? Had they understood the Philippine-American War? And likewise, Afghanistan, you know? I just think that there's some parts of this history that have been so dulled to American memory that it has been to our disservice as a nation. And that's not, you know, that should be a lesson about sort of why history matters. And I think that is the big failure of that moment, really, was to preserve the history in a way that people understood it better.
Sounds like you've got your next exhibit here, right? From maybe the Indian Wars to the War of 1898 to Vietnam to the Global War on Terror, you know, America, anti-insurrection. I mean, I know you're going to be depressed, you know, doing more research on that. I want to ask you one last question because we're running short on time. And I think this is quite possibly one of the most important questions I'll pose to you, which is, how do you think that galleries like the National Portrait Gallery tell our history different than the books do? And I mean, it's interesting that, you know, it's the 125th anniversary of the war, and yet there aren't that many books that I can see out there that have been released to talk about the war. And yet there's this exhibition that's on that is doing the heavy lifting. So how does it do it differently?
I think Diana and I are biased because we're art people, right? So it's an experience. It's a phenomenological experience to walk through a gallery and to be confronted with a portrait of Queen Liliuokalani. It's right in the sight line behind McKinley. She overshadows him. And that is honestly such an interesting visual to contemplate, maybe to wrestle with, to spend time with. And so when portraiture comes face to face with you as a viewer, and you see people with their dignity, you know, kind of being presented, and you understand a little bit about their biography, I think it's a bridge through time in a way that books don't necessarily have the same connection to the reader sometimes. I mean, we all love books, right? But I think that it's just a different experience in a sense that the sensory experience of an exhibition like ours is unforgettable. And people are going to be thinking about it, you know, for time, you know, year after year, we hope.
What Kay just said was absolutely beautiful and captures it beautifully. I think the only thing I would add is that for a long time, the museum repeated the history that was in history textbooks in the most conventional way, I would say, you know. And I think the 21st century has brought energy of renewals in museums, particularly that have national missions. Certainly in the past 5-6 years, but also in a stronger way after 2020. However, we have to remember that this exhibition was in the books before that, you know, and I think that that's something to make really clear. We've been thinking about it for a long time already. We're doing a show in a museum that understands that it needs to probe chapters of history that have not traditionally been probed. And so, you know, that it's important to ask, to go into difficult chapters, into violent chapters, into chapters where the aims of the nation ran in contradiction, as it was said, not by me, but in 1898 by the anti-imperialists, you know, in contradiction to some founding principles. And so it's important to examine that, right? And I think, you know, we're lucky to be working in this time in history where it is possible to do a show like that.
Being beautifully put by both of you. And thank you very much for joining me. The exhibit is on display until February 25th, 2024. Kate LeMay and Taina Karagol, who I'm going to get the enunciation right at some stage, are the architects of this beautiful exhibit. And I would encourage everyone to go out and visit it. And thank you both for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
It was wonderful.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. You can follow the Gilded Age and Progressive Era on Twitter or on my website, michaelpatrickcullinane.com. Please consider subscribing or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, because it really makes a big difference and helps direct others to the show. I hope you'll join me again for the next episode.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.